But I don't know what the dates are for the community of Marks, but if I can find it out, it's.
We'll see if another school is going to.
Exams don't end until the 22nd or something.
Yeah, it's probably early January, but it's pretty standard, I think, for most places. It's like chapter 2 here. I can't find that out, chapter 2, but it's out. So, you know, buy one for your parents, buy one for your family. Stocking stuffers, it's.
The cover was a lot less intimidating.
Yeah.
Hey, Cliff, are they in the basement or in the school?
I don't know if they're physically here yet, but they, they're orderable because they can order them. That's right. I'm happy to facilitate your ordering them if you want. They're cheaper if you buy them in groups of 10, you know? I'm actually a little disappointed that there's typos here that actually weren't in the galley, so that there's somehow in the process, in Appendix C, for instance, there's all the substripts got shifted. But it's not that bad. Any questions about last time? Is he, how's the assignment going?
It'd be going better if we knew it was due later.
I had a question, though, about the assignment. Next term, supposing, next term, would the assignment be exactly the same size for every month? Because that would be, I think, way too much. It would be the same amount every month.
You want more, okay. So what I would do in the term would be, you know, I'd probably just give you one assignment again, but it would be for the whole term. The problem with, once you get to chapter 4, so you're calculating things, then there's a zillion of things that can be asked. So, but they also, you know, you don't necessarily learn more by doing the same thing over again. So I would aim probably at, again, having one assignment, probably a little bit longer than this assignment, because it would have, you'd have, I'd give it to you in January or something, so you would have the whole term to do it.
So it would be the same order of magnitude, the size.
Yeah,
but 4 months
instead of. Yes, are you guys finding this is really kind of taking over your life?
Yes.
No, it's, that's good. No, some of it's kind of, it's hard to remember to judge how long it's going to take you guys to do it, because you'll see that once you've done it once, if you go back and redo it, what was 10 pages, you're like 2 pages, because you don't make all the mistakes.
Yeah.
When are you going to be deciding what you're going to do? People are going to figure out what classes to take.
Oh, next term again?
Yeah.
The plan would be to do it next term.
I think we have one for my consultant.
Did the conference or
the ECO?
Yeah.
And so how flexible is it? We had conflicts in the master, we moved them. In the university, because those are all different. It was a graduate course.
Yeah.
So,
but
what
it's really hard for graduate courses.
So, how many people are in that course?
I would have to take
it. I have another course which I'd like to take, which would complete.
But it's unusual to have a graduate course which has 30 people in it, right? That's the thing. So
well, pretty much everyone that is from Waterloo.
Yeah.
In this course, will have to take that.
Yeah.
Not everyone.
It's because it's a required course. Sometimes you get a lot of students. Plus, there's gloves.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. There's going to be like 30 or 40 students in the class here. So it's not.
Yeah.
You wonder why I'd say you're teaching E&M too.
Yeah, you can teach us.
Yeah, just say it's E&M too. That would be great.
That's all. The tricky thing is that coordinating the three universities on a day is going to be really a nightmare.
So
whereas with any university, it's easier to move things around. So that's when we had the conflict in Hamilton, we fixed it faster.
So this class is also involved. So there's two, I guess, universities involved now.
Well, the one with the.
All courses in Waterloo are well.
So in practice, how many people are from all the courses?
On average, you see about 5 people because of user
group. There are 5 at 12 and about 30 at Waterloo.
Yeah.
Because all the monsters you just take it.
Yeah.
So it'd be really nice if you could take me in the book.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, but the problem is they're going to say, well, don't take it, don't take standard model, take E&M because it's required.
Well, I don't know, you people check these things. Yeah.
They don't let you graduate.
So, like,
eventually,
right? Wait, something.
It's required to check. The thing is that what works very well with this day is that there's a globium and people are spending the entire day coming here to the store. And so that makes sure that
one required EMS. Because we have one required EMS, one required quantum mechanics, and one required spectrum.
Yeah, all. There's a little leap up, maybe we'll be kicked in. So I'll have to tell me about that because he's of the, not only the contact guy.
Yeah.
So that it could be, if the test could be done so that we don't move this for us, that would be working best. From having everyone coming out of town and spending the day. It's another day, it's hard to see how to fill the day in a way that we can do the town.
And free lunch.
What's that? And free lunch. So that's my preference, at least. I'm not a good one. Is there an issue at Western with that? I mean, do we have it at the same time in the evening? Okay. All right. So we're finally at the nitty gritty, right? We've got the center model. So that was the last thing. I didn't actually write the gauge kinetic terms for all three of the gauge factors. And then you had fermionic kinetic terms all around, so we had minus a half. Some over all the fermions. Oh, I'm not aware of the fermions. So we had, so on the left hand side, we had E bar on. So that was all the fermions in the gauge fields. That was the only thing that's allowed, which is normalizable, transforms the right way. And it had the property that nobody had a mass. So we stuck in this pink sector. So we had minus E phi dagger phi minus B of phi. And B, I chose to be lambda 2 in the other way. Do this is going to be making contact the way I would have written the book. So and then there were Yukawa couplings. So we had so now I gotta remind myself. So the quantum numbers were on these side here. So remember the quantum numbers of all these fields were we had the quarks, which is a triplet under SU. The left-handed piece was a triplet under SU3, the doublet under SU2, and its hypercharge was, so we wanted the up quark at the top, it had charged two-thirds, or one-third, and so that was one-half plus a six. And the down quark was the bottom, and that was a half, minus a half, plus a six. No, that's not right either.
Yeah, it's not six.
So we wanted it, so Q was three plus Y. And for up and down quarks, the charge here was two-thirds and minus third, right? So we have two ups and down, that would be proton, that's the plus one, and two ups and up, two down would be zero, it's neutron, and up, right? So then this is a half plus a six would be two thirds, and minus a half plus six would be minus a third, that's right. So 6 here is a hypercharge. Then we had the F force was it was a left-handed thing with a 3 bar, it was a singlet under SU2, and its hypercharge was the same as its electric charge. So this was the left-handed piece of this thing is the anti-up force, so that has charge minus 2/3. So we had the same thing for the down force, 3 bar, 1, and plus 1/3 for the same reason. The electron doublet was a singlet doublet. And then the hypercharge was, the neutrino was at the top and the electron was at the bottom. So the neutrino was, had no electric charge, so it had to have a hypercharge minus half. And then the electron singlet, and then had charge plus one, because this is the left-handed positron. Then the Higgs, I wrote as being something neutral in the bottom, something on the charge plus on the top. So that was a singlet, a doublet, that had charged, hypercharged plus a half, if that make those charges work. And I can always take phi twiddle. The complex conjugate of this thing won't be quite a doublet, but remember there's an identity that the Pauli matrix you satisfy that. Take the Pauli matrix, complex conjugate, that's the Pauli matrix times the second Pauli matrix on both sides. So. And the second Pauli matrix is basically the anti-symmetric tensor in two dimensions. So if I write this, so tau 2 is, you know, I times the anti-symmetric tensor, the way I normally write it. So that's zero times minus I, zero minus I, zero. So if I write a phi twiddle to be epsilon phi star, that's also a doublet. But it's got the opposite hypercharge. And I couldn't do that for the fermions because the taking of the star would have made left to right. So it wouldn't have been, or I could have done it, but instead I'm just kind of, these are Majorana, so it wasn't giving me anything new. But this is a complex field, so it's giving me a field. So I told you.
Sorry, why did that we chose the Higgs to be better?
I didn't quite tell you, and it's because I'm about to tell you. I want to have something which will give me masses. So the thing is, I know how I'm looking for bilinears of the fermions, and I know how they transform, and I have to have something that will combine those two things to give me a singlet for the Lagrangian. And so that's where these charges are coming from. So when I write this thing out, it's supposed to see where the choices came from. So,
can I ask a question about similar to the assignment? So when you write down this action, is this the quantized version or the classical action? Like, because then the question is very easy to use the standard ordering when quantizing.
Yeah.
But isn't that the story of the standard order?
Well, there's a story there that I'm literally not saying much about.
Right.
And it's, so you should, strictly speaking, this is the classical action I'm giving you here. And the ordering issue is tied up with the divergence issue, because the failure of these operators to order is typically happening at the same space-time point. And so if you change the order, you'd be doing that at the expense of adding things here, which would be looking like the deltas are zero, and they're diverging at small distances. And it's because of that statement that this is the classical thing, and I haven't really been careful about making it a quantum thing, and that's going to be, when we talk about anomalies on the road, that's kind of one way of thinking about the anomalies, is that the claim I'm making is that the having a symmetry of the action is the same thing as having an operator commuting with a Hamiltonian. And the operator commuting, you know, charge commuting with a Hamiltonian was coming as being in a field theory, it was the integral over all space of some current. And the current is conserved because of the equation of motion which comes from the action. So there's a connection. If you choose, once you've chosen the action and you're making a story about the currents being conserved and that meaning by things meaning with Hamiltonian, that really would, I should do that properly by having told you what the ordering was first. And what happens, the one way I think of the anomaly thing is that everybody thought until the 60s that that was just all details, and that, you know, so if there was an ordering, it would work, and until someone figures it out for you, you don't care. But it's, for some symmetries, it's true that there is no ordering for which the current is conserved. Like, classically, the current is conserved, there's no ordering in the quantum theory which is conserved. So the implication that a classical symmetry implies quantum symmetry, or quantum conservation law, classical symmetry implies a classical conservation law, it's a theorem, but classical symmetry implying a quantum conservation law is necessarily a theorem because of this operator ordering spring equation motion out. And so that was such a surprise that people thought it was anomalous. So they call anomalies the failure of that classical quantum set of symmetry. So there's something which I haven't got to yet, which is going to be, you know, that when we do the, so part of that thought, here's the new thought. So the new thought is that the one reason to think of this thing classically is that when you really do this in a field theory course, you'd be doing this in a path integral. And in a path integral, you need the action in the path integral, and this would be a classical thing. And then all the issues of operator ordering, you can think of as coming from the measure. There's another way of thinking of the path integral. So in all these ways of thinking of it, there's a way of, in which the anomaly arises, so it's something which is true in all cases. And the reason the path integral is so different from the operator version is that, you know, when we do perturbation theory with the operators, you're thinking of Hamiltonian all the time, because E to the minus IHG is the thing that's evolving in time. So when you derive cross-sections in terms of the perturbation Hamiltonian, the expression you have explicitly involves the Hamiltonian. But when I actually start calculating things in chapter 4, you're going to see that what I'm looking at really uses the Hamiltonian as minus the Lagrangian, which is not the right thing when you have, it's often the right thing, but it's not always the right thing. And in particular, when you have spin 1 particles, it's not the right thing. The Hamiltonian, the interaction Hamiltonian is not minus the interaction Lagrangian. And there's a long song and dance that they did in the 80s, the 50s, and the 40s, where it turns out that the interaction Hamiltonian is minus the Lagrangian, interaction Lagrangian, plus a bunch of non-covariant terms, which are not even Lorentz invariant. And these things, the non-covariant terms go through and they systematically cancel the failure of covariance that comes about because of the time ordering that are going to appear in that perturbation theory. So this is amazing, marvelous cancellation that goes on, which, you know, it's amazing the first time you do it, but then if you had to do that every time you did a calculation, it would be really annoying. And so what's nice about path integrals is that they phrase the whole thing in terms of Lagrangian. So the bottom line of the cancellation is that you get the right answer. It's as if the Hamiltonian was minus the Lagrangian. And in the operator language, that's kind of something you only see happen after this long cancellation takes place. But in the path integral, it's obvious because the whole thing being phrased in terms of the Lagrangian. And that's why people use path integrals for gauge theories, is that whole mystery of the cancellation, you never have to think about it. So in where you're going, you would really be thinking this is being classical actually anyway. So
for the assignments, do you just...
So for the assignment, it's a quadratic thing. Just do what I said, take 1/2 the anti-commutator as the operator of the order of description. That's normally motivated by making up an intermission. It kind of thing. Everything has to be intermission that you have. Although it's not clear that it will be an intermission. That's the thing with the subject is that you really need like a year and a half to do an honest treatment of all these issues. And so there's a number of things that I've been skating over. And I'll try and tell you that something has been skated over as I skate over it. So you know that there's something there to look at. So we're looking for EPAL couplings. We want two fermions and a scalar. And so what I want to do now is I'm not going to take the point of view of what would I need for the scalar and give them the fermions. What I'm going to do is, here's the scalar, what can we make? And then you'll see once I'm finished why I chose the scalar this way. So I'm writing these transformation rules out because, to make something invariant, you have to make it invariant under SE3, under SE2, and under the U1. And so right away, this scalar doesn't transform under SE3. So to have a prayer for the SE3 invariant, we have to right away, we can only imagine taking two fermions that are not singlets, not triplets, and combining them. Or we can take a, you can't take two triplets and get a singlet out of it. The analog, if you did spin a half for SU2, there's rules for when you combine angular momentum. If you have, angular momentum J1 multiplied by angular momentum J2, then that decomposes under angular momentum as being the sum of, it starts off with spin J1 minus J2, and then it's the sum of that plus 1 all the way up to J1 plus J2. So that's the way the spin is combined. And there's a similar story for SU3, that if you take a, and it's not a big deal. It's if you just take a, remember that three component thing is a, it's like a vector with a complex vector with three indices. If I take two of them, like here's another one with a complex index, I've got something with two indices here. And the statement is that under multiplication, the group multiplication where these things both rotate by a unitary transformation, the symmetry or anti-symmetry of this combination is preserved. So if I take the symmetric combination of this thing and I ask, if I apply a symmetry transformation to it, the U3 transformation to it, the symmetry of the thing under these indices doesn't change. So if I take the symmetric combination and anti-symmetric combination, those things are separately transforming into themselves under the action of this SU3. And so that's a decomposition of this product into irreducible representation. So what happens is that the, so if I have a three, so the symmetric and anti-symmetric pieces here transform separately, and the trace in particular transforms all by itself. So if I take a three, I lied to you with the trace. Three with the three, that says that there's nine things in this representation. The symmetric combination would have been a symmetric three by three matrix is that six thing. And then the anti-symmetric combination is a three-dimensional representation, and it turns out that it's the complex conjugate representation of the three. So just make that explicit. If I define the symmetric thing as being vi wj plus wi vj, that's something which is, the symmetry of that doesn't change under multiplication by these SU3 matrices on these indices. So that's something which is a six-dimensional representation by itself. And the anti-symmetric combination is also one. And the fact I wrote it as a three bar, one way to think about that is that there's two invariant tensors for SU3, because the statement that U, dagger U is equal to one, says that delta ij has the property that is invariant under the action, under multiplication by three by three matrices. And the fact that the determinant of U is equal to one is the statement that the anti-symmetric three index tensor whose entries are plus or minus one is also an invariant tensor. And so if I have something anti-symmetric like this, I can always make something, with one index by contracting it with the anti-symmetric tensor. And so that's why this is a three bar. It's something which can be, you can make an invariant out of it if I combine it with another three. That's going to be useful. That's why protons are color invariant later on. So here's an aside that two threes can't make a singlet in particular. So I can't make an invariant Lagrangian of two threes, but a three with a three bar, I can. If I take a three and a three bar, to think of an index upstairs, I can always contract that with the invariant tensor delta ij to make a singlet. So a three with a three bar makes a singlet. So I can combine these guys with each other to get an SU3 invariant. I can combine these guys together. I can combine these guys together, but I can't combine any other pairs and make it SU3 invariant. So there's three options as to what we could be looking for, given that we decided not to have this thing involved in the color story. So let's write those down. So we have, there's a convention as to what I call GH and G. Make sure we're not longer than that. For F, H, and G. So F is L and E, H is Q and G. So we have Q bar, L bar, I. I think my convention is I'm using gamma right here rather than gamma left. Yeah. Okay. And then there's got to be a Higgs here which I haven't written yet, so I'll just leave the space for it. And there's G, I, J, Q, R, I, camera right, DJ, and there's a Higgs thing here on the right, plus F, G, H. So the complex conjugate will give me the piece. This is going to be complex in general once I finish writing it. So the complex conjugate is what makes the Lagrange real. So far we've only checked the SE3 invariants. So now we're at the SE2 invariants. So SE2 invariants for this first one, we've got this is a doublet, and this is doesn't transform to SE2 at all. So there's this thing is a column vector in the SE2 space. This has got a neutrino, E, and an electron. And I can contract that with this or this, because these are both doublets. And which I should choose will depend on which hypercharge I'll need to make V1 work. So let's go back to V1. So if I take the right-handed piece of these charges were the left-handed charges, right? But since I've chosen perversely to write the right-handed one here, the hypercharge here would have been plus one half. The right-hand part. And the hypercharge of the this will be minus one. So this whole thing had hypercharge minus a half, so I need something with hypercharge plus a half to make the whole thing V1 invariant. So that would be this one. So that's going to go with phi. And you're supposed to think now, if I had written the SE2 indices, this is a doublet dagger because of the bar, so it has an index, if you like, an SE2 index upstairs. And I'm contracting that with the SE2 index downstairs. So if I wrote that out, which I will in a second, as being new.
Should
bar,
it be 512?
I don't think so. Let me check that I'm not lying to you. I'm not lying to you. All right, I'll come back to that thought in a second. Let me just finish this up. So just to parse this thing, what this means is it's this transpose gamma right EJ. And so the spinner indices are contracted between the nu bar and the E and the E bar and the E, right? But then the SE2 indices are contracted between this two-component column vector and this phi plus phi naught. So you're supposed to think of, you know, this one, if I multiply out the SE2 indices, I've got nu bar I gamma right EJ times phi plus E bar I gamma right EJ times phi naught. Just to make it explicitly clear what the indices were like. And so now going back to this is a phi rather than a phi twiddle, because this has hypercharge minus a half, this has hypercharge plus a half, so this combination has hypercharge minus a half.
But right? You said that the left hand and right hand units of the hypercharges, right?
But I've already switched them, right? Because when I wrote plus a half here, what I wrote here was minus a half.
So the hypercharges you've written for the Higgs field are right-handed?
Well, the Higgs field doesn't have a hand, it's a scalar. So the So let me suppress. You can't see that up your ears here, so that's why I'm not writing them, but so you see explicitly what I mean here. That's what's going on. Same story here. So this has got hypercharge. Q was 1/6, so the right-handed piece would be minus 1/6. D was 1/3, so the hypercharge would be right at piece with minus 1/3. So this is summed together to give me minus a half. So I need to think of plus a half, that's again 5. So again, I'm contracting the SE2 index for these two guys in exactly the same way. So if I did the same thing as I did here, I would have written this as being up bar I gamma right DJ I plus down bar I gamma right DJ I naught. So here's what that means. And here, this is minus 1/6. And now this one is plus 2/3. So that together is plus a half. So I need a thing which has got hypercharge minus a half. So that's this one here, 5/12. And so if I wrote this out explicitly, and this is the matrix 0, 1, minus 1, 0, times phi plus phi naught star. So that's the column vector phi naught star minus phi plus star. So I'm doing the same. I have to now do the same contraction now of these guys, and you can see that this is going to be up bar I, gamma right, up J. Times the thing on the top here is phi naught star. And minus down bar I, gamma right, up J, phi plus star. Okay? This is like the other room you can. So that's all you can write down. That's SE2 plus SE3 plus E1 invariant. And now you can work backwards in a minute. And so if you had to invent what you would need. What's happening here is that phi naught, the neutral guy, is always paired off with the two pieces of the electron. Right? That down quark is going with phi naught, and phi naught is also paired off with the u bar. And when we give a non-zero value to u, to phi, we don't want to give the photon a mass. So we want the electrically neutral guy here to get the non-zero value only. So we're thinking that's the one that will be non-zero in the vacuum. This one will be zero in the vacuum because it's got charge. And so when we give that something non-zero, then we want electron mass, we want an up quark mass, and down quark mass. And so what we were looking for is something which, working backwards, we wanted something like this, and like this, to come have a Higgs that will go with it to give it a mass. And so no one had this thing transformed. It was a double of the hypercharge minus half told me that this thing had to be double of the hypercharge plus half. And that's how you, so you're working, what you really do is you work backwards. Yeah.
So why would you take the right-handed part something, or is the left-handed in the complex conjugate?
Because there's no loss of generality in doing that. Remember when I did the mass terms in general for the Yukawa couplings for two Majorana fermions? There's always a 1 in the gamma 5 piece, and there's a reality condition that makes the coefficient closing real. But I can equally, instead of writing it that way, I can equally well write it in terms of the left-handed part with a complex coefficient and add the complex conjugate. And then the real part of the coefficient will become the 1 piece, and the imaginary part will become the gamma 5 piece. So this is the most general thing I write. And it's convenient to do it this way because it's the left and right-handed pieces that are transforming a specific layout of the group. So you can follow the symmetry here for the left and right-handed parts, and you can for the 1 and the gamma 5. Yeah?
So why does the Higgs field there give the photon zero mass in that left-hand turn, but not give any of the quarks zero mass in the right-hand terms?
You think if I wrote these things out, would I get something which was not involving just these combinations?
I mean, I'm just trying to see how we're only using the photon zero mass and that.
Oh, the photon and the mass, that you shouldn't see yet. That's something I'm okay. Looking in here. I'm going to do that in detail, yeah. But it's what I'm playing off now is that, remember from the scalar example, the scalar electrodynamics example, the generic thing was that if you didn't give a path to the in general, you expect that the things that are lighted by symmetries will have the same mass unless the ground state is not invariant. And so and also the gauge fields, they like to have no mass at all unless you have if you don't break the gauge symmetry. That was kind of what the scalar electrodynamics thing taught us. And so the thing I'm telling you, but which I haven't shown you yet, is that if you break all of the symmetries by this, by having the expectation value of this thing not be invariant, then all of the gauge bosons will get a mass. But if there's some combination which is not broken, then it should stay massless. And that's what's going to happen. So we're going to design it so that this thing, if you had many Higgses, you could set things up so that both these things get a mass, and you'd find that you'd have 4 massive bosons in the SE2 plus E1 sector, and no one could be a photon. So it's going to turn out that there's a massless guy here who's going to be the photon, and it's going to couple exactly with electric charge, and it's not an accident, because I've been choosing the hypercharges by requiring, I choose the hypercharges to make this the electric charge the way we know and love it. And then I'm choosing, with that choice, That's what this meant. This was the electric charge of zero. And I'm going to design it so that this thing is the only thing that's a non-zero expectation diagram. So I've designed it so that this electric charge will be the thing that is the coupling for the massless thing in the problem. So it's going to be, the photons are going to work for free. But it's because of these choices that have been made. I've been choosing these hypercharges in just such ways to get the electric charges to be the ones we would like them to be. And then the Higgs has been chosen so that I can make this thing non-zero and this one zero with any more potential.
Does this mean that doesn't follow this?
It does follow it, yeah.
Well, it falls out, but you've made choices in order to make it happen.
I made it follow, yeah.
So it's not really...
It's not really falling. It was selfish. Yeah, it's going to look like magic, but it's not magic. If it hadn't worked this way, we wouldn't have been running this model down. And so the thing is, part of the purpose of these exercises and the homework is to try other things. And you start making different choices for what this thing's going to do. You can make other choices which go wrong on you, and the levels at which they go wrong on you, one of them could be that you don't have a minimum, which is only electrically neutral things become non-zero. And once you've done that, then there's other things that can go wrong, which the assignments bring out, and I mentioned to this thing a lot. So it's kind of, by doing a couple of examples, you can kind of see the things you have to be choosing to make it all work. There's a certain amount of art form. For the simple, small representation, it's not such a big deal. But when you start doing, people do grand unified groups with gauge group E6, and all these bizarre groups, and they're making the same choices, and they're using the same things to guide them. But it's really, you get to choose. The thing that's inevitable is once you've chosen the fields and how they are transformed into the symmetry, then what you write down is fixed by the gauge invariant. And so the thing you get to choose is what were the fields and how they transform. Okay, so now the next step is we want to split this thing into an unperturbed and a perturbed Lagrangian. Because it's going to be true that these couplings are essentially all going to be small for some choice of energy range. And for many couplings, it's for all choices of energy range of interest. So perturbation theory is going to work, but the caveat that you got from the scalar field theory case was that we have to make sure that when we divide this Lagrangian into an unperturbed and a perturbed part, we're careful about doing it around the classical energy minimum. And I've designed this potential so that that energy minimum cannot happen when the scalar field is zero, because if the scalar fields were zero, this whole sector wouldn't have done anything for us, because we're trying to generate masses for everybody, and those are only going to be generated if these fields are not zero in the vacuum. So that what we have to do is minimize the scalar field, and then expand around that minimum, and keep the things that are quadratic in the unperturbed part, and the things that are not quadratic in the perturbed part. And there's going to be the same story as we had before, where there will be pieces in here which mix derivatives of the scalar field with gauge fields. That will complicate our ability to read off the masses. And we'll get rid of those the same way we did before, by choosing a gauge. So we had this freedom to do these local symmetry transformations. And we'll remove some of that freedom to get rid of these cross terms. And then we can read off and all the masses. And then that will be the free part will just grab a bunch of massive particles that are not interacting, and then the interacting part will be their interactions, and those interactions will be controlled by these kinds of couplings and the gauge couplings that are good in these derivatives. So that's the rest of it. So let's just do that. So the only thing that's at all complicated is we've got these coupling matrices. F, we had four parameters. I didn't write down the I could have written down the theta 3 little epsilon mu nu lambda rho g alpha mu nu g alpha lambda rho. Those kind of things. This is could have been there by gauge invariance. It's an embarrassment that it's not there. As far as we know, this coefficient is bounded to be 10 to the minus 9 at best. So that's kind of a puzzle that we'll come back to. But given that that's not there, there's a coupling constant for each of these three gauge factors. And that's all there is up until this problem. So everything is parameterized by three things. And that's going to describe much of the electroweak interactions that are universal. And then all the masses are hidden here, and there's you know, there's not just three couplings here, there's a matrix, a 3x3 matrix of the couplings here, and a 3x3 matrix of couplings here, and a 3x3 matrix of couplings here, because I and J run from 1 to 3. And so we have the freedom to diagonalize things in their masses, and so the complicated part will just be algebraically complicated. We just have to read off the masses, and then once we've done it, we want to diagonalize all the masses the way we know we always can. But now we have these interactions, we want to follow what do the interactions do as we do that diagonalization. And do all these interactions stay? You have a 9-component set of matrices here in the interactions in general. Or once we've used the freedom to make the non-interactive piece take a canonical form, does that simplify the interaction side of things? Here it does, the way you can see.
So is that magic, or is that forced in as well?
That is, it's more magic in the sense that that wasn't really designed in, but if it had failed, you would have known this was the wrong theory. Because it's strong, the main thing is going to be that these matrices are all going to be diagonal once you go to the mass spaces, these matrices. And if that hadn't been true, you would have known it pretty easily. Because there's very, very strong experimental limits on flavor changing interactions. And historically, that was used to predict the existence of the, when they only knew about the up, down, and strange quarks, the charm quark was predicted because you'll see when I do it, that if you didn't have things coming in complete generations, then you would get things that were neutral and linking different generations, and that was a problem.
What's the physical interpretation of the term that you cross out?
It's it would be something in the strong interactions which breaks, the reason you know it's not there is that it breaks parity and timer result. And so it would, in particular, give rise to things like an electric dipole moment for the neutron, which it doesn't have, and there's good limits on them. Because it's electric dipole moments, you can get them, you know, things have electric dipole moments, but they typically do if they have orbital angular momentum. So having something which is structureless have an electric dipole moment, the Wigner-Eckhart theorem says that electric dipole moment has to be proportional to the vector, because the whole thing is rotational invariant. And the only thing you've got is spin if there's no structure to it, there's no orbital angular momentum. And then does the spin and electric field transform differently under time reversal? So you can't have it be proportional unless something broke time reversal. And so that selection rule makes it, you're very sensitive to the existence of that kind of term. And it's known not to be there because the neutron dipole moment is known to be less than 10 to the minus 23 some units. E centimeter probably is the universe. I can't remember what the error for that is. All right, so the first step is we need to minimize potential. So classical energy minimum. So the potential was written in a way which kind of makes it clear what it has to be. Phi star phi has to be V squared of 2. And so that doesn't tell you in detail what, remember, phi was a two-component thing. So we're not learning what they are separately. We're only learning the sum of their absolute squares is constrained. And that's much like in the case of the scalar electrodynamics. We learned that the modulus squared of the scalar field was something, but we didn't know what the phase was. And that's because we have a symmetry here where you know, we're free to take, you know, the SE2 cross U1 takes phi to some unitary matrix times phi. So there's a lot of freedom to rotate around in this space because we have this symmetry. And we can do this locally in position. This thing can depend on position, because it feels can, because it's a gate symmetry. So we can use this freedom to simplify what these choices are in the vacuum. And so I'm going to use, thinking ahead to the story up here, we're going to be interested in getting rid of the terms which mix the gauge fields with the derivatives of scalar fields. I'm going to make a choice here which is going to be guaranteed to kill this off. And that's where the choice is coming from. And it's just a choice. So let's choose what's called, again, it's called unitarity gauge, unitary gauge. And this is motivated. It's not the only way to get rid of these cross terms, but it's the simplest way. So we want to kill off the a mu, e mu phi terms in L naught. And so the gauge choice we'll choose is that phi is, we'll just make this guy zero, which we can always do by one of these transformations. And we can make this guy real, so we'll make, and I'm going to choose it to be 1 over root 2 v plus h of x. So this is a field and this is just a number, and this v is the same v because with this choice, I've arranged that when h is 0, phi dagger phi is v squared of 2. And then 1 over 2 just is this the 2 0 conditional.
You define the mu dagger phi term to die off or to disappear.
Yeah, if I had written them out explicitly, which I'm not going to do, and they had the general form of, it was something like saying, you know,
I'm just saying that it's not a sentence.
Yeah. Oh, does that sense?
Motivated by requiring the any time that my parents did not know.
Oh, you need a verb there. Okay. Thank you. as I said, I was not going to do what I was going to do with. I'm not going to give you the credit cards.
Keep it all in your
mind. That's right. You have to find a book with your own credit card. All right. So the claim is that I can get here by doing a unitary transformation of this type. And it's also, you know, how many transformations I have here. I had there's three transformations in SE3 and there's one in U1, so there's four functions worth of parameters in there. And this choice I've made, you know, I've set three things to zero here. I've set two real fields to zero because this complex field is zero. And I've set the imaginary part of this one to zero. So you should expect that after having done these three conditions, that this is zero and this is real, I've still got the freedom to do something here because I had four functions worth of parameters I could use. And the thing that will be left will be the electromagnetic transformations, which leave this unchanged. So what you should be expecting is that what I've done here is I've chosen the gauge, but I haven't actually completely chosen the gauge. I've not fixed the one of the U1 subset of this thing, which I'll come back to later on. So with that choice, all we have to do now is expand everything out. So let's write out the. So we're going to identify. This non-interacting interacting piece by expanding powers of H. And that's because we know that phi dagger phi 1 over. Half b squared when h is 0. That's kind of why h should be chosen. And I should have said here that h is 0. So the imaginary part of this is 0. Sorry? Yeah, that's also called h. Yeah.
Oh, h is just some other thing.
H is in the field here. So it's h for h. It's unfortunate, but it's economy of letters. So I'm going to call everything h and then. By context, you'll know which one is which. Bryce DeWitt used to do that. He had the field theory course where he has this great summation convention where you sum indices and there's a summation convention for all the repeated indices. And he'd do that as a functional integral too, that you'd have a summation convention where these indices could be continuous variables. And then he'd stop writing them. And so there was a matrix notation where the indices were not written, but the ones that were repeated were summed over. Okay, so let's do that for the Higgs part. So the Higgs part is just the stuff involving phi. We've got so there's a v we can write out. The v is lambda times pi dagger phi is just 1 half b plus h squared minus b squared over 2. So that's 1 round over 4. Now the v squared term cancels the v squared by construction, so the first term here is going to be the cross term, and we're going to get, I pulled the 2's out, so we're going to get a 2vh, and then there's an h squared. So if we write that out, that's it's lambda over this lambda, v squared h squared, that's quadratic, and then the rest of it is interaction, so we have 2 times 2 is 4 over 4, so you know, plus lambda b h cubed, plus 1 4 lambda h squared. And then the kinetic term, we can write down. So d mu phi in this gauge is, so d mu, remember, is this partial mu of 0, 1 over root 2, plus h. And the derivative kills b, so I don't have to write that b term here. Then we have the gauge covariance stuff, right? So we had a minus, phi had hypercharge a half. So the E1 piece is going to be minus G1 over 2, d mu times 0, 1 over root 2, b plus h. And then we had the SU2 piece, which was minus 1 half G2 WA mu times the Pauli matrix, A times 0, 1 over 2, H. And so we can write this out explicitly, right? If I write that I use a WA mu tau A, W1 multiplies the 0, 1, 1, 0, so that'll be, I'll get a W1 here. V1 here. W2 multiplies 0 minus I 0, so I'll have a minus I W2 plus I W2, and then W3 multiplies 1, 0, 0 minus 1, so I'll have W3 mu minus. And this thing is a unit matrix, I could think of that as being. So if I write the whole thing out, D mu phi is 0, 1 over root 2, D mu h. Because the V gets killed. I have minus 1 half times the matrix. G1 D mu plus G2 W3 mu. And W1 mu minus I W2 mu. W1 mu plus I mu. And G1, or there's a V2 mu. G1 mu. So if I'm interested in following, let's start off with the mass terms. The mass terms, I'm looking for things in here which are linear. Everything here is at least linear in a field, right? Because this one is linear in H. If I use V here, then these guys are all linear in the gauge fields. So that this thing is linear, but it also has quadratic things involving W times H. Say. And I'm going to square this in the action. So the mass terms are going to come from just keeping the V here, pitching the H. But if I want to then figure out the interactions afterwards, I just think I can take V and put the V plus H. So I might as well keep them both, just to solve the whole thing. So when I do this, if I do this matrix multiplication out, I've got 0, 1 over root, I'm taking 1 over root 2 out of everything. On the bottom, I've got D mu H. Well, that's not taking 1 over root 2. I forgot 1 over root 2. No, it's over there. Good. I'll see that. So if I just do the matrix multiplication, these guys are always hitting 0, so I only care about these guys, right? Now your column vector, the top one is G2 W1 mu minus I W2 mu. The bottom one will be G1 D mu minus G2 V. And I'm supposed to have square that to write this term here. So, so minus dmu phi dagger dmu phi is going to be, I'll have, on this term squared, I'll have minus 1 half dmu h. In principle, I'd have this term times this term, and I have screwed up because there's a factor of I missing. Remember like, that was it's minus I gauge field. That's quite important. And the reason that's important is that what I'm taking here is the absolute value, so that it's the real part squared plus the complex part squared. And the real times complex parts cancel because you're taking this complex conjugate times this. So this is real, and this is imaginary, and so you don't get a cross term between this and this, and that was kind of why we made that choice, that this we designed this thing to be real, so that we wouldn't get a cross term that involved the derivative of the scalar multiplied by a vector. So the cross term between this and this is zero, you know, by construction of the gauge, and all we have left is this thing squared.
But I mean, you have an imaginary term inside that thing there, so that must be canceled.
Yeah, but that's at the top. See, and this thing's at the bottom. Well, if I'm doing a dagger here, and so this thing multiplies this thing, and the zero multiplies that one. So all I got left here is minus 1 over that squared will be 8. So I've got u plus h squared. Times the top part, absolute value squared, so I'll have a g2 squared, w1 mu, w2 mu. And this thing I'll have plus g1b minus g2w mu, g1b minus g2w3. Right. So now we can combine things, and in this split L0 plus Lm, we can take the Higgs part of everything, which is where all the masses are, and see what the masses are. So this I can just think of as being a kinetic term, which I can lump together with all the other kinetic terms up there for the gauge fields and everybody else. And the masses we can all read off here. So L mass will be the quadratic part of the Higgs term involving no drift. And that's going to be this stuff, plus this. So it's minus lambda v squared h squared, and that stuff, minus 1 8 v squared, 2 2 squared, so we can read off the masses now that we're supposed to compare this to, you know, minus 1 half m h squared h squared minus 1 half m a squared v a u v a u. We have a bunch of vector fields. So the Higgs mass you can see is going to be, it's going to be 2 lambda v squared. So the heavier mass is, the bigger lambda and v are. W1 and W2 only appear here, so they have an equal mass. So we have MW1 is equal to MW2, and that's going to be 1 half G2V. And then there's a combination of V and W3, which is getting a mass. And the orthogonal combination, you know, G2B plus G1W3 is not getting a mass. But we need to know how to normalize this. And remember, if we're going to call this a field, we have to make sure that the redefinition we do doesn't screw up the kinetic terms, which we've chosen to be minus 1/4 times something. So we have to normalize this linear combination of B and W3 so that it says we don't change the normalization. We want a rotation term, not a rescaling, because we don't want to change the kinetic terms. So that means that if we define Z to be G1B mu minus G2W3 mu, we should really divide it by the square root of G1 squared plus G2 squared if we don't want to screw up the kinetic terms. That thing is going to have a mass, because that's the thing that's appearing here. And so this mass will be mz squared, where mz will be 1/2 b times this combination, now the square root of this times z, and I've got two of them, so I'm going to give it an overall factor of the square root of g1 squared. 2 squared. And then the other combination that's orthogonal to this one, but also normalized, will be massless. Let me just write this in the thin-light complaint. So then, so a mu, which I can take to be g2b mu plus g1w3 mu divided by the square root of g1 squared g2 squared. That's going to be massless because there's no, the only combination of these things that has a mass at all is this one. So this will be the, what we hope to vote on. Yeah.
Oh, just the mass of the things. Should that be squared?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I couldn't have anything there. So it's customary, you know, this was designed to be a rotation, right? So it's, the reason I divided by this thing was to not change the kinetic terms. And we saw in general that the most general redefinition of a bunch of scalar fields or gauge fields, which doesn't ruin their kinetic terms if they're already been canonically normalized, is an orthogonal transformation amongst them. So we can always write that transformation for Z as a rotation. We can write Z mu. Z mu, A mu, is cosine theta, sine theta, minus sine theta. For some theta, and let me just use the signs as a convention as to where the signs is there. Let me make sure I get it right. Blah, 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 blah. Z should be W cos minus B sine. So that's a minus sign there. Times W3 mu. And so you can compare this to that, and you can kind of read off that so cosine theta W is G1, I'm sorry, it's here. The mass term was quadratic with that anyway. So this is G2 over the square root of G1 squared plus G2 squared. And sine theta W is G1 over the square root of G1 squared plus G2 squared. That's how I should have seen the sine if I compared that. And you can check that this squared plus this squared is 1, you know, hey presto. So that was kind of guaranteed because we were asking for the kinetic term not to change, so we knew we normalized everything, so we had to worry about it. So this is called, theta W is called either the weak mixing angle or the Weinberg angle, depending if you like Blaschow or Weinberg. So I think it was first, I don't know who wrote it down first, actually, but history of it is. So it tends to get called both things. Yeah, and the good news is it's all W, so you don't have to worry about committing yourself when you write it down. And I'm often going to shorten this to C sub W, just to save writing. Now we have C sub W. Okay, so so before turning to this is the boson mass, like you said, not that we haven't done the Yukawa, but we're going to have Fermi masses. But you can kind of see that there's potentially it's interesting because. You know, what makes this whole thing powerful is that it looks like there's three parameters here. There's G1, there's G2, and there's B. And there's three masses. Right? There's the Z mass, the W1 mass, the W2 mass. The Higgs mass involves a new parameter lambda, if you want to talk about the Higgs mass. So it looks like there's not anything you can really say there because there's as many masses. But you can just design G1, G2, and B to make all the masses that you want. But the interesting thing is that the Gs, you can measure those by going, you know, those are also the things that control the interactions between the fermions and the Higgs bosons. If you go back up to the fermion genetic terms, G1 and G2 are in all those covariant derivatives. So what makes this whole thing predictive is that when we go off and actually calculate the implications of the interactions, we'll have a way of measuring the G1s and G2s directly. And in particular, that will also allow us to measure the sign theta W. And once we've done that, then there's a prediction here for that relates to these masses, because the V is the only thing in this formula that has any dimensions at all. Right? Everything else is dimensionless. This is a V that has dimensions because it's the BEV of a scalar field. It's going to turn out to be 246 GeV, which once you see how it's measured. But the ratios of these masses don't involve V at all. So the ratios of these masses involve only these coupling constants, which you can measure elsewhere. So that's an important test of the whole thing, will be the comparison of the masses you get to the couplings that you infer from the interactions. So let me finish off of that. So the two comments I'm making are, you know, comment number one is the only parameter in the whole model with dimensions is V, which turns out to be 246 GeV, as we'll see. So all masses, including the fermions when I get there, all mass ratios are fixed in terms of dimensionless couplings, which you can hopefully both measure and by looking at scattering of the Higgs. For the Higgses, that's less useful because the Higgs couplings involve the couplings between the scalar and the fermions, which hasn't been found. The scalar hasn't been found, so it's hard to measure where these couplings are. So there's not going to be predictiveness there until you actually see the scalar field. But for the gauge fields, we know a lot of those couplings. So for the W's and Z's, the W1 and W2 are normally just referred to as W for reasons I'll come to in a second. If I call MW just MW1 and MW2, which are equal, and there's a reason why they're equal, you can see by comparing those formulas that MW over MZ squared, not squared. So MW, it's 1/2 V times something. In this case, it's 2. In that case, it's the square root. So that's D2 over the square root. And that's cosine of theta W. So if you go up and measure this thing, and you compare that to these masses, that's one test right away of whether this whole picture is right. And it works. That this is 80 GeV, this is about 90 GeV, and sine squared theta W is about 0.23. And so if you figure out the cosine, that makes this work. And that's this relationship is not true if you start doing different things like having more than one Higgs doublet or other representations we could have used, which could have also given us masses for things. And so it's kind of the detailed tests like this that are part of the package of constraints on what you can do in this sector, which is breaking the electric weak symmetries. And the fact that this doublet succeeds so well is belief in the doublet is coming from a lot of indirect pieces of evidence like predictions like this.
So apart from the fact that the Higgs boson hasn't been observed yet, is there any other reason to believe that it doesn't exist? Because lots of people seem to have doubts about that.
Well, everyone will have doubts until you see it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's evidence that it's there coming from, if it's there, the more, as time has gone on, everything else has been pinned down. When you didn't know the top quark was there either, there was a long period of time when the top quark hadn't been discovered either, but people believe it was there. And if there's one thing missing, like there is now, then given that you can measure the mass of the top four kind of things directly, the precision with which these various things are tested is now at the better than a percent level. And so you're sensitive to the corrections and perturbation theory. And those can involve virtual Higgses. And so there's an indirect sensitivity to the Higgs mass through its effects in loops for things. And it tends to be only logarithmic, so it's not the strongest dependence, but it's there. And it favors the Higgs actually being toward the lighter end of the range that you could imagine entertaining. So the standard model gives a good description, and it gives it the best description that the Higgs is like because of these loop effects, because the precision of the measurements are so it's good enough that you can actually be sensitive to the mass of the Higgs experimentally. But the assumption is that the only thing in those loops was standard model stuff. If you have something beyond the standard model that could be faking the standard model of like Higgs by giving the same loop effects, because it's an indirect test you're making. So no one will really be happy until you actually see the Higgs explicitly. And then test that it's seeing a scalar won't be good enough, because there'll be an analog of this statement here, that if you see the Higgs and it's a standard model of Higgs, and all the couplings of the Higgs and the fermions should be portions of the mass. And so that to be the standard model of Higgs, you have to have all those couplings right. And so that's where you'll lose your gains in information if you start measuring the couplings of the scalar that you see to the particle comparing it to the mass. The last thought was, why is this true? You know, this is true so far. Everything I've shown you is something which is lowest order perturbation theory. It's what we had in the unperturbed Lagrangian. But if we actually calculate the energy levels of the Hamiltonian in perturbation theory, there will be corrections to all the energy levels. And in particular, this one gets corrected. So that there's when you make the comparison with the experiment, you have to worry about corrections to this. This one doesn't get corrected, and that's because of the symmetry which makes these two have the same mass. And that symmetry is electromagnetic invariant. So if you go back, I remember I said that my watch is slow, actually. Maybe I'll pick this up next time, because I can see it's not pretty good. So I'll fix up that one.